go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming out to Mary Patton's reading. Yay! If you've never been here, we are a volunteer-run activist center and Fair Trade Cafe. We sell many books, so check us out after the event. And we have events like this almost every single night. Suggested donation is $5, but whatever you can contribute is greatly appreciated, and your gratuity helps keep events like this happening and keep our doors open, so I'll be passing around a bucket now. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce Salem Callow Julian of Half Letter Press.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for coming out to Blue Stockings tonight. And I'm Salem Hall Julian. I'm from the group Temporary Services, and we run Half Letter Press, which published Mary's book. We wanted to thank Blue Stockings so much for their generosity in hosting this event tonight. It's one of the perfect places in New York to host this event, so I'm really glad to be here. They also participated in a project we did in September called Market, and it was great working with a couple of them more closely and hearing more about how their collective works, so thanks again for that. Mary and the three of us in Half Letter Press have been putting together this book, and by putting it together basically means putting the finishing and final touches on an incredibly great text that already existed for many years, when you think about it, but really for a big chunk of time before Mary approached us to publish it. The core of the text was written in conjunction with an exhibition that happened here in New York about 5 years ago.
2008. Signs of Change.
Signs of Change, which was collaboratively curated by our dear friends Dara Greenwald and Josh McPhee. So in honor of Dara, who unfortunately passed away earlier this month, I'd like to take this moment to dedicate this evening to her memory and to all of those who seek to fight and be brave and funny just like she was and just like Mary is. My voice is with a virus. So if you'll forgive me, I'm going to read from Mary's biography that you can read yourself in the book, so that if you can't understand some of the things I said, hopefully you'll buy a copy and you can read it at home. Mary Patton is a visual artist, a writer, an educator, an occasional curator, and political activist. In all of her work, she seeks to address collisions as well as alignments between the worlds of politics, in quotation marks, and art making. Posters and ephemera from the Madame Bin Graphics Collective were included in Signs of Change at the Miller Gallery, at Carnegie Mellon University, Pacific Northwest College of Art, and Exit Art here in New York between 2008 and 2010. Several of Mary's murals are included in On the Wall, Four Decades of Community Murals in New York City by Janet von Reinitz and Jane Weissman. Her writings have been published in Radical Teacher, in Area Chicago, The Passionate Camera, and White Walls. A selection of her videos are available from the Video Data Bank. She is a founding member of the group Fuel Tank Chicago, Politicizing Depression, since 2003. And she also works as an associate professor in the Film, Video, New Media, and Animation Department at the School of the Art Institute. And it's a joy to be working with you, Mary. And without further ado, Mary Patton.
A music stand here. Thank you so much, Salem, and the other members of Temporary Services and Half Letter Press, Mark Fisher and Greg Bloom. They're a collaborative that exists between Chicago, Copenhagen, and Philadelphia, and that's pretty amazing given that it's a collaborative of three people. So, briefly, Salem, and thank you so much, Blue Stockings, for hosting us. This is a fabulous place. I've been to Blue Stockings for event, not just a shop, but for events and readings. For example, Marilyn Buck's Rescue the Word. No, I've got the wrong book. It's the City Lights book.
State of Exile.
State of Exile, the translations. Anyway, there's a lot of emotion around for lots of reasons. One of which is that actually the first time I came to Blue Stockings was with Dara and Josh, because when Dara and Josh were kind of making the transition between moving to Chicago and New York, and before or in between spending time upstate in Troy, they kind of made the Blue Stockings Cafe their office and would hold court and meet all kinds of folks here. And so I'd heard of Blue Stockings for a long time, but it really was, that introduction was really through them. And there's a memorial for, this is ringing, there's a memorial for Dara that's a kind of marathon event that's at 16 Beaver, just in case some of you all don't do Facebook, which I don't, you might not know, but Dara's an amazing person, and we'll talk about her a lot this weekend. You know, I teach film, video, new media, but I'm really bad being in front of a mic. I'd much rather be videotaping you people. So can we just dim the... Hey, Stephanie, how are you? Can we dim the lights a little bit? I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe we can dim them quite a bit. Yeah, good. I'm not sure how good that image looks, but looks good? Okay, good. Actually, I think I need to be a little bit more... Yeah.
Do you want all the way out?
Well, no, then I won't be able to see anything, and I'm not that good at being completely extemporaneous. So what I'm going to do first is just go quickly through some images which kind of correspond to... There goes my Kleenex. which correspond to the ordering of the book a little bit. So one of the things to say just really quickly is that if it hadn't been for Half Letter Press and Temporary Services and for this kind of entrepreneurial site called Kickstarter, which probably a lot of you participate in, we wouldn't have been able to do the project. But it was basically a vehicle for us to appeal to a lot of people, many of whom are in this room, who could donate anything from $5 to $500 to make this project happen. There's a lovely picture that Mark Fisher took to make it this reality of the books in the box. So the Madigan Graphics Collective was, although when we started, we didn't formalize ourselves quite that way, but we really were a kind of graphic arm of the May 19th Communist Organization, which was an entity that traced its genealogy back to that part of the white left that people most popularly associate with the Weather Underground. And it was, the organization was, we were very conscious of the importance of names. So May 19th was the birthday of Ho Chi Minh and Malcolm X, and also the anniversary of the death of Jose Marti, who's considered the father of the Cuban Revolution. Anyway, this is a pamphlet of May 19th's statement that, of course, the illustration was done by us in Madame Bin. Madame Bin was the name of the woman who was the Vietnamese negotiator at the Paris Peace Talks. So the Graphics Collective grew out of... May 19th had a kind of, we had a structure, we were a cadre organization. That's actually defined in the book. I'm not going to do it here. As best I can, I defined it. But we were structured on the basis of collectives. And your collective was your, was I suppose, a little bit like a cell, except we weren't a clandestine organization. But the idea was that you weren't privy necessarily to what was happening in another collective, but you had this intensity of evaluating practice, otherwise known as criticism, self-criticism, through the collective structure. Apart from the, quote, primary collectives, we, and I forgot, this is really bad, to introduce, there are people, there were Laura Whitehorn in particular, there are other folks in the room who were part of the graphics collective, and that was really bad manners, but I'll introduce you guys when the lights go. So I'm sure there'll be corrections or differences of valences of opinion, but there women in May 19th who were artists wanted to find a way to create a vehicle where we could be useful to the politics of our organization and our vision, and contribute something meaningful through art practice. So what I'm going to just go through very briefly is some of who we owe our graphic debts to are obviously the Paris 68 student and worker insurrections and the posters that came out of that. This is actually Italy. Whoops. These are photos by Purple Jones of women and the Panthers on the West Coast. This is a poster from the Mexican student movement in about 68. And we owe a huge debt to the graphic work coming out of the Cuban Revolution. And so I'll just quickly go through some examples. John Hartfield. And also here's an example of a peasant painting of the during the roughly the period of the Cultural Revolution in China, which is really interesting still to me because it goes way beyond the kinds of codes of Soviet-influenced social realism in the excess of fish. it's like more than necessity. I was also part of a graphics collective when I was a student at Rhode Island School of Design. I was a dropout from many art schools when I was young. And some of the women in that collective led me to the people who became my close comrades in New York, who later we were in May 19th together. But unnamed Providence-based women's graphics collective did a lot of activity around this first Women's March on the Pentagon, which was in 1971. And we only used paper stencils, touche and glue. Those of you who are printmakers, very sort of not photo silkscreen. Those of you who know Cuban posters can recognize totally what we appropriated there in terms of image. This is by Dottie Wertz, who is somebody we worked with, a dude, printmaker Swiss. He's an amazing printmaker. He's dead. This is kind of an amazing poster. So the kind of visual vernacular of these owes a lot to what was happening in Europe and, you know, the Paris 68 pieces, obviously. Anti-imperialist Etruscan women. This is one of the murals that now this is kind of amazing. This was supported by New York City CETA money. You know, there used to be city money for once. Yeah. I mean, this is a Maoist mural that's still Josh McPhee took a picture of this. It's really faded now. But evidently it's still here. It's a Lancian Forsyth. But it's kind of amazing. And this project, the City Arts murals, were created by teams of artists who worked very closely with young people. The young people in this project were mostly Chinese American and Puerto Rican kids who lived on the Lower East Side. The team of artists included two white women, me and a woman from the RCP, and a bunch of Asian American artists who were leftists and part of groups like York, Kuhn, Maoist groups. And Tommy Kochiyama, who is the son of a longtime anti-imperialist activist, Yuri Kochiyama, who is a close colleague of Malcolm X's. Tommy was the person who came up, was a great, we had a really great Paulo Freirean process where that really was this kind of dialectical thing, and Tommy, you know, Tommy was 15 and came up with this idea of the flag to unify all these disparate parts. It was defaced. I don't know if you can see the white paint on the lower right, but kind of minor. Oops. Okay, I know because of time, I'm going to go through this a little bit. So, this iconic image, this photograph, I don't know, Laura, maybe you remember who took this picture.
No, I remember that picture.
Yeah. I mean, it's so emblematic of the place in the imaginary of the left worldwide that Vietnam occupied, that was about a kind of ferocity, courageous but nurturing revolution. Those of you who haven't seen the film Grimm Without a Cat, I think there's an excellent exposition of what was the significance of Vietnam. So anyway, then there's a section in the book, The World is Our Archive or Whose Appropriations. Part of this has to do with the discussion that was everywhere in the art world in the 80s, where, you know, Sherry Levine would take a Walker Evans photo, photograph it, and sign it as her own. There's a kind of very elaborate discourse around appropriation that kind of in a way made it sort of special, as if there hasn't been borrowing and stealing and repurposing and collaging going back ages and ages. But the kind of way we all appropriated images is that you borrowed, and I know there's a huge controversy about Shepherd Fairey, and we could talk about that if you want, if you think it's interesting still, maybe it's not. Never mind, we won't let Cindy Barry, not going to do it. But there's a kind of open borrowing that, all in the interest of solidarity, that was practiced every place. So there's some examples of that. So this is a poster by Rene Medeiros from Cuba, whose subject is Vietnam. And they're just a series of little crude drawings for a three-part mural that I did with Tamia Arai, who's an artist some of you might know, to celebrate the Vietnamese victory in 75. And here's another Cuban poster by an artist named Fremez, and the Chicago Women's Graphics Collective remake. And here's a really wonderful poster from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Cubans borrowed from posters and graphics from the Black Movement, something Josh McPhee has written about and other people. So it was certainly not just one way. And here's a really overwritten flyer that we did. Oh, well, okay.
For us, that hardly says anything.
Well, also, we turned the now thing into a snap.
We were before our time.
So, quickly, I always say quickly, it's a warning, it's not going to be quick. So now I'm going to start to read some stuff from the book. This is one of the first posters we did in support of two major political prisoners, Sundiata Okoli and Asada Shakur. Sundiata just turned 75. He's still in prison, but very healthy, and I just learned he has email. No, it's amazing. And anyway, you see George Jackson, there's a kind of, you know, there's this kind of, I don't know, the drawing for this I did. And I was way into this sort of, like, you know, I guess maybe it was channeling Tommy Cochiano's flag idea. For the artists in the Madam and Graphics Collective, the art world was not our home. We were uneasy interlopers, having rejected the nexus of gallery, museum, art collector as inherently elitist. No less overt, but often unspoken and unarticulated, was our belief in the impossibility of an art practice outside or independent of our all-consuming and demanding politics. Our role eventually became that of simple propagandists. The ambiguity of art making and any kind of open creative process was supplanted by unambiguous, urgent, and militant political speech. Earlier I discussed the beginnings of the Madam in Graphics Collective, where we exercised a degree of autonomy in our creative process. We alternated designing our prints and posters, allowing them to bear the particular markings of style, drawing, and design of one individual, while the rest added to the conceptual development and production. Donna Borb created the design for the Destruyendo el Monstruo desde las Montañas, Viva Puerto Rico Libre poster, forgive my accent. Laura Whitehorn, who is here with us, did what I think is our best poster, the Attica poster. Look at it, it's really good. This name's, for those of you, I know most of the people in the room are familiar with this material, but some maybe are not. This is a list of all the prison uprisings and rebellions that were happening in the era of Attica in 1971 and post that. And that's George Jackson's portrait at the top. And Margot Pelletier designed this second Puerto Rico poster, which also I address a little bit in the section called A Kaleidoscope of Guns, because that's kind of what Margot did there. And sort of what the, beyond the obvious, what the interest, the imagery of the gun was, especially the AK-47. This is a very bad slide, but it's the only one that exists of the last show that Group Material did in their storefront space on the Lower East Side. And the exhibition was called Atlanta, an Emergency Exhibition. Hey, Betsy. Oh, I'm sorry. Just saw somebody I didn't see before. In 1979-1980, there was an epidemic of murders of black children in and around Atlanta. And eventually, this guy, Wayne Williams, was tried and convicted. But huge questions remain to this day. He's still in prison, as far as I know, about what was that trial about. The same period of time, there was an escalation of Ku Klux Klan activity. For a long time, these murders were not solved, probably about two years. Anyway, Group Material did this project, and Madam Bin was invited to be part of it. Group Material, Julie Ault put out a book called Show and Tell. It's a big book. It's really interesting because it documents a lot of Group Material's process, and you see these internal notes between Group Material members where it's funny, there's one exchange where they talk about the Madam Bin people as being kind of nuts. Yeah, it's funny, like those stories. But interestingly, and it took, I think, Greg Schled is in the back in the room, and Greg wrote the afterword piece for my book-length essay, and Greg's writing reminded me, I had sort of put the timeline of this project earlier, because I had this thing in my head that as we got more and more isolated in our politics, and less and less interested in engaging with people, and just not just that we wanted to preach to people, but we wanted to hammer people over the head. There was only one way to be a white radical, a white revolutionary, not just our way, but we had to be like John Brown. We emblematized some of those politics in the pieces that we did for the show, but we did an installation, which was really unusual for us. And this was actually just a couple of months before we got arrested. So the timeline analysis doesn't really work. I mean, we were still kind of very extreme in what we were doing, but maybe it's just the opportunity of this invitation. Well, there's no documentation of this project we did. This is another bad slide that shows we did an op art painting. It's a lot of focus, but the op art is based on that. So, and that's really weird color, but the color in the previous one is right, but you can't really see it. And then we did this installation that Lucy Lepard describes in a great book of hers that's out of print called Get the Message. This is some of our ephemeral work. mentioned that already. This is a picture from a Frelimo camp in Mozambique. I think this is from the book Prairie Fire. Margot, yeah. Okay. All right, so I'm going to jump now to, because maybe Greg can tell us the Carl Andre story. This section's missing. I have to actually go to the book. Okay, realism. Okay, now I have to move slightly. The struggle over color is alternately funny, bizarre, and troubling. In our work, the artists in the Madam and Graphics Collective were alternately praised for overcoming our own racism enough to be able to, quote, see, and therefore, quote, represent, the faces and gestures of black people, and criticized for white supremacy when we couldn't predict the outcome of an offset litho split fountain or duotone. When land that was supposed to signify the rich homeland of the South for millions of descendants of slaves looked, in the words of one of the leaders of May 19th, like shit. I should also be clear here that a lot of this process of criticism and self-criticism was generated by ourselves. It wasn't as if we were just, you know, there was some abstract leadership, because we all took turns being secondary leadership at least. Okay. One of our new African comrades once told me that she'd never before met a white person who could draw or paint black people. I was embarrassed and secretly pleased, but it nonetheless seemed like undeserved praise, since I attributed this not to politics, but to my ability to render forms and colors naturalistically. In the midst of the feedback session about Southern Song, a particularly ambitious seven-color print, she joked that the colors of the land looked more like grassy Connecticut than the red earth of Georgia. So, it may be just be a different exposure, but we did do different versions of the piece, and we did attempt for it to get richer. Internally, this became fodder for more organizational criticism, first as evidence of my overly familiar banter with someone whom I should have treated more respectfully, then of the always dreaded, always already there racism and unwillingness to dig into, believe in, and really represent the five states of the nascent black nation. The Pombere Zimbabwe poster was controversial because we used a flat burnt umber with no modulation in hue or value for the skin or the faces of the children, freedom fighters, and ZANU leader Robert Mugabe, and we all know who he is. The color printed so dark that it absorbed the thin black ink lines that delineated their features. Rather than a design flaw or bad color or paper choice, this incident was argued as evidence of our racism in that we flattened and dehumanized the faces of Zimbabweans. And there's some other examples, I think, like, okay, so this is another Cuban poster by this artist, Rosgard. Most of these Cuban artists are dead. And this is for a film about an escaped slave, Cimarron. And obviously he had a much more open approach to color. But there's the famous story that some of you know of David Hammond's piece, which was a re-rendering of Jesse Jackson as a guy with blonde hair and blue eyes. And it was positioned as a public art piece in Washington, D.C., which you can see a little bit here, the process of it was defaced, and then it had to be dismantled and then situated inside. You know, just this was a little bit too open. Like, what does he mean by this? It's a little bit too troublesome. As if art always has to advocate something. I'm repeating myself here slide-wise, but I'm going to cut these out. Okay, I'm going to read from this part now, How to Disappear Without a Trace. And I'm going to go back to the this paper because it's slightly bigger. Any artist working collaboratively alongside or negotiation with a community in struggle must live with and work through the tension between losing oneself in that struggle, that community, where fighting for the greater good tends to eclipse the particular, the singular, and the everyday. The manifestations of this might include anonymity, solidarity, clandestinity, or just focused and dedicated hard work. Those who choose this kind of political practice find their lives intensely enriched and multiply connected to worlds beyond what they ever knew previously or possible. Worlds where possibilities beckon and where being oneself also means sacrifice, sometimes to the point of self-obliteration. I have in mind two images. One, a newspaper photo of Thich Quang Duc, whose self-immolation and protest against the Saigon government in 1963 became one of the key icons of the Vietnam War. It was literally burned into our consciousness and made its way into numerous magazines, documentaries, and films from Ingmar Bergman's Persona on. And another, Assata Shakur's Welcome Here, a poster that was put up in windows and storefronts in Harlem, Brownsville, Bedford-Stuyvesant, and the South Bronx after her escape from prison in 1979. The poster is signed by the Republic of New Africa. The liberation of Assata Shakur is remembered as a signal moment in the annals of the Black Liberation Movement. It may seem occult to those not involved, and that's not a cult, that's the word is occult, like hidden. It may seem occult, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be obnoxious, but just, it may seem occult to those not involved in or touched by these struggles, but the possibility of an incarcerated freedom fighter escaping from prison in the U.S. with no cost of life is practically unimaginable today. Even Shakur herself, in her autobiography, figures the escape as a kind of dream. Because of the dictates and necessity of a clandestine mentality, none of the actual actors are ever named, thanked, or acknowledged in her book. That naming was only to occur in indictments by grand juries and persecution by the state. The Madam in Graphics Collective produced a number of anonymous works, or, as in this case, signed the poster, The Republic of New Africa, the name of the group for whom we made the poster and who we were intent on projecting. This is not so unusual. For years, anti-imperialist activist Yuri Kochiyama, an old friend and political associate of Malcolm X, who I mentioned earlier, designed calligraphy and flyers for the Revolutionary Black Nationalist groups in New York City with whom she worked. Only people inside the movement knew that the hand behind these graphics belonged to Kochiyama, who never claimed authorship. There's nothing wrong or a lot right with this in principle. It's a solidarity gesture. But what needs to be scrutinized in our case is the act of inflating the apparent visible support that existed for certain revolutionary tendencies of the Black Liberation Movement at the time, and in the process, the attempted erasure of our whiteness, our insistence that white people had no escape route from the trappings of white privilege, no other avenue to becoming revolutionary than to go to war, was an attempt to disappear into the imagined masses of the Black liberation struggle. And I also try to be clear that in a footnote, that I don't mean imagined as in, you know, completely fictive, made up. There was a basis to our vision, but it was a very driving vision that eclipsed a perhaps broader and more nuanced possible view of politics at the time. Oops. That's there I am. There's Donna, Eve, and Margot. Anyway, I hope you don't mind. I called you out there. But it's mainly me. I mainly only say me. Okay. Four of the key members of the Madam in Graphics Collective, or I guess five, I don't know. I think everyone was in Madam at some point. Because everyone likes to make graphics and art. Four of the key members of the Madam in Graphics Collective were arrested in September of 1981 at JFK Airport at a demonstration against the Springbok South Africa's rugby team. And again, I'm not preaching, but I'm talking to people who are very familiar with, this story, particularly because there have been some mainstream movies made about it. But the Springboks was the name of South Africa's rugby team, which in the late 70s, early 80s, was a tool that the apartheid regime, which was crumbling, was using to, as cultural ambassadors to build up legitimacy for a fraudulent white supremacist regime. But the only countries that let the Springboks in on this tour were the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and the United States. And on the East Coast, there was a major game scheduled for Albany, the state capital, and we went up in buses, lots of people, anti-apartheid activists from New York, and we did a kind of symbolic circle around the field, the stadium. And as the Springboks marched into the field, we chanted, we held hands and we chanted, "We're going to stop the tour, can't take it no more. We're going to stop," we're just chanting at them. And when the game was over and we loaded ourselves back onto the buses, I remember that black students from SUNY Albany and African students got on the buses and said, What are you people doing? You say you're going to stop the tour, you can't take it no more, this game happened. Who are you? What are you really doing to stop apartheid, right? So that really got to us. And we thought we really needed to give them a send-off. Anyway, it was a kind of a riot. Anyway, we were charged with criminal trespass, resisting arrest, and assaulting police. Soon after, one of our co-defendants was indirectly implicated in the Brinks robbery in Nyack, New York, the disastrous event that marked the beginning of the end of May 19th. This is a person who was asked to lend their credit card that was used to rent a car that was used as a getaway car in the robbery. Many of you saw the New York Times Magazine 2 weeks ago on Judy Clark. That story is in there. Not our story. Between 1981 and 1983, the Madamon Graphics Collective effectively became an imprisoned collective working from the main New York City jail on Rikers Island. Even the daily grind of incarceration, controlled movement, constant noise, mindless and routine searches, provocations, and round-the-clock surveillance did not stop our activism or our graphic production. We created prison art with permitted materials, collages made from torn-up magazines, toothpaste substituting for glue, Elmer's glue's contraband. We made portraits of fellow prisoners and drew pictures of their children and lovers from photographs they lent us, sometimes for cigarettes, sometimes just, for love. We mobilized the veritable cottage industry to make drawings, cards, paintings, and paper quilts for our annual craft sale for human rights, of which Madonna was a shopper. She was a shopper at our craft sale, which now became a focal point of anti-repression and solidarity work. Our energies were also consumed with legal meetings, making propaganda for various defense committees, including our own, and against grand juries and other forms of state repression. We had now become political prisoners, political jailed people, formerly the idealized subjects of so much of our artwork. Oops. And the last section I'm going to read is called No Special People, which is from a prose poem by Tim Blanc, who's one of my co-defendants and a former political prisoner, and the full sentence is, "There are no special people, only extraordinary circumstances." At the same time that artist Hans Hacke was making his U.S. isolation box, Grenada, 1983, this is a piece in protest of the U.S. invasion of Grenada. This was also work that met with political and corporate censorship and media attacks. At the same time, some of my friends and former political associates were bombing the U.S. Capitol building. I don't mean that went on for weeks, that was an action. But those things did happen in the same period of time.
Also by Grenada.
Well, yes. Anyway, yes, and actually, if you could read this, which I can't for the screen, but it would explain that. So this is a communique from the Armed Resistance Unit. This was the Sun-Times. I was in Chicago at the time, and so that's the version that we used to their headline with the communique to hand out at the protests in D.C. After the invasion. I remember seeing the logo of the Red Guerrilla Resistance at the top of the reprinted communique and feeling a shock of recognition. The graphic style was deeply familiar. I felt a chill similar to the fear I'd experienced when a stranger's face in some city looked like that of someone I used to know who was now underground in hiding. I avert my eyes. I must not give myself away, must not acknowledge the recognition of the encounter. In the fall of 1990, during my first semester of graduate school at the University of Illinois in Chicago, I showed a piece that I called No Special People. I don't have documentation of the piece, from the same quote by Tim. The piece was a series of small black and white portraits of six of my comrades who were all in prison at the time. Alan Berkman, Laura Whitehorn, Susan Rosenberg, Laura and Susan are here in the audience, Tim Blanc, Marilyn Buck, and Linda Evans. Alan and Marilyn are no longer on this planet. The piece was a series of small black and white portraits, each blocked by a 6 by 9 inch steel rectangle. That's what you see here. I'm kind of move this into another piece. The approximate size of a cell window, from my experience at Rikers anyway. The gray plates were then drilled into the paintings with 6 inch stove bolts, making the painted heads difficult, although not impossible, to see. At my critique, visiting artist Thomas Lawson, who's a painter, who was kind of a bigwig at the time, but also was a very, he kept trying to make associations with Irish Republican prisoners as a kind of foil. Like, everybody knows about the IRA, but nobody knows who these people are. What do they represent? I was befuddled by the intent of the question, given all the theoretical debates about representation that were swirling around those halls and classrooms at the time. This was like the height of what we used to call postmodernism. I was also exhausted from working all night to install the piece, so I really couldn't talk. But through my physical and conceptual fog, I heard the question as an accusation to which there was only a dull, despairing answer. Here were these people buried alive for 10, 20 years or more, but they were nobodies. No one knew their names, who they were, or what they stood for. Oops. Later, in developing this piece and extracting elements from it for Prison Diary, which is this here, Untitled Conspired, which was a collaborative installation that those six people, the resistance conspiracy case defendants, did with me, which was so incredibly generous and amazing because I asked them to participate in an impossible collaboration, meaning we couldn't be in proximity to one another and develop this piece. And they kind of took time out of their necessary legal and political campaign work to accede to my request, and we arranged for them to make collect calls to me where they described differently the experiences of being in detention, of being in jail, and of the contact with fellow prisoners, the contact with guards, the sort of ambience, the experience of seeing a horizon or not, etc. And anyway, turned into this piece, which this is kind of a version of it, but not quite. And Letter to a Missing Woman, which is a kind of experimental fictional short piece about some of these experiences. Anyway, I wrote that I wanted to interrogate the official accounts which condemned people like us or people like them to virtual life sentences as terrorists, to smash pop psychology explanations that dismiss them as white middle class kids who hated their parents. That's a kind of analysis boiled down from maybe Todd Gitlin's view, or were abused by them, as well as progressive left versions that spurned them for their adventurism, folkloism, and militarism, or captured them as self-hating anti-working class whites. motivated by a ridiculous romance with the third world and by overwhelming guilt. I knew that my friends were special, exceptional, a sentiment I imagine most people shared if they knew about them, whether they supported or despised them. The idea of revolutionary will, or lack of it, was a constant theme in the political circles I inhabited for years. The title, No Special People, intended irony, but most viewers, like Lawson, had no idea who these prisoners were. The question of what they represented opened a void, and not only because their names never became household words, like those of the Red Army Fraction revolutionaries in Germany, whose blurred portraits by Gerhard Richter were the inspiration and reference for my piece. That's the newspaper account. And that's his painting. And his father and Mrs. Gudrun Enslin, and one of his portraits. And this, the last, I'm just going to end with a couple of photos that were given to me by a video maker who prefers to remain nameless, who interviewed the police in Nyack, who's interested in doing a kind of documentary about the whole episode, and was taken downstairs to the basement by this captain whose face I've smudged out. And there was what he called the Brinks Museum, which were all these photos, and this is long after the cases were over, photos, index cards of kind of, we've all seen this technique in the movies, you know, this kind of mapping of the characters in a case, or The Wire. But this, they kept this up, anyway. This is a continuing dilemma confronting the painful truth that despite the risks and the sacrifices, the bravado and extremism, and the dire consequences of our political project, so much of our work, our efforts, and more recently our political prisoners are invisible and seemingly irrelevant to contemporary social movements in the U.S. And then I sort of ended, there I am on the wall. But I'm going to end it there, but actually I think that the there's a kind of epilogue. There are kind of few epilogues to this little tiny condensed book, because the history bears repeating by different actors who can argue with each other. But I think the question of relevance has certainly shifted because our world is shifting, because of Occupy Everywhere, because of things like not only the New York Times piece that makes people aware of the case of Judy Clark, but David Gilbert's book, Susan Rosenberg's book, Laura Whitehorn's book, all the work that has been done that makes a lot of connecting threads. So on that note, I'd like to end, and perhaps, I know, we can clap, but and then I'd like to introduce a couple of people to you all. Can we have some light? Laura, would you mind, some people know you, but would you mind standing up and saying hello to everyone? This is Laura Whitehorn, one of the key people in the magazine. Well, of course, but can you let me introduce a few other people? Susan, do you mind, would you say hi? Susan Rosenberg, who wrote An American Radical, which should be on the shelf here somewhere. I could keep on introducing people, but I didn't really ask her, but I did ask for permission if I could introduce her. So
that's okay. Thank you.
Is it all right? And Greg Chalette, I would like everybody to please give a big hand to him. Greg, I don't know if you want to come up here, if you just want to like remain semi hidden, semi occult in the back. It would be lovely. Greg generously wrote the afterword to my book-length essay, which is not a booklet, and maybe not quite a book, but it's a book-length essay. And Greg, we might have been, well, Greg, hey, Tom, how are you? Greg was one of many people who we harangued, but not into oblivion, clearly. Greg was a student at Cooper Union when Donna Borup taught there, and so there's some really interesting connections, and Greg has a great story from the Art for Zimbabwe auction, which he actually writes about in his afterword. Laura, did you want to say something now?
I just wanted to say that Mary's book has sort of, I mean, it's not, all of us have our own views of a lot of this stuff, and, you know, I would have some comments to make and stuff. But Mary's book has brought us together in a really wonderful way, I think, and has created a bridge for, I mean, I talked to Josh and talked to Dyra before she got sick and died a lot about art. And so I think that your attempt to put it, to take two strands, one is left history and one is art history, and put them together is really very, very helpful, and I thank you for it.
Thank you, Laura. Laura was one of my readers and was quite critical in really interesting, good ways. And, hey, Sarah, how are you? I keep calling people out. Greg, don't go away. Okay. Yeah, do you guys want to say anything? Would you like to...
Well, I just
talk about darkness.
You mentioned the Carl Andre incident, and I guess the reason it's both funny and maybe somewhat relevant is that I was a young art student, just arrived in New York and just graduated from Cooper Union, I guess, or I was just about to graduate, studying with Hans Hacke. So my work was already very much thinking about this relationship between art and politics and how does one go about it. And of course, Hacke was a conceptualist and coming from a very different kind of angle from what you folks were doing. So at some point, I can't remember, I guess it was through Donna, who was my instructor and was involved in Madame Bin. She was my instructor at Cooper before she went underground. She invited me to be part of the benefit that you folks did for Zimbabwe, which had just got its independence, from it had been Rhodesia, of course, and the revolution, etc. And I was one of a number. I mean, I'm a young person with all these really famous artists and exciting people. Social realists, mostly, except Carl Andre, who most of you probably know is a political person and considers himself, I think, a Marxist in some kind. So he had submitted a small work for this auction, which was about this big. It was a series of small metal panels. I don't need to describe his work. You know what it looks like. Made of copper, and you simply assembled it. It came in a little box. It was like portable Carl Andre. And somewhere during the auction, you had a live auctioneer. You remember more of this. And this was brought out after all these paintings and these kind of, you know, very sort of exciting, mostly realist graphic work. And it just started, people started laughing. At least a few people started to laugh. Okay, so I'm this young guy studying with Hans Hacke and thinking, you know, we're very into this kind of conceptual political perspective. Carl Andre is really important in my pantheon, new to New York. Okay. But I'm thinking, why is this so funny, you know? I didn't have the $75 in my pocket, which would have purchased the piece, unfortunately, along with many other unfortunate why I didn't buy those things in New York when I could have stories. And of course, the piece at the end of the day, it disappeared. Is that the story? Because I didn't know that side of it. Anyway, it was really kind of intentional.
No, it's really. I mean, I have all sorts of like theories that somebody who knew what it was really worth on the secondary market, you know, but not for their own gain, you know, to support some revolutionary.
Right.
Of people somewhere, but yeah, no, because it's sort of to this day, yeah, the fact that it disappeared is kind of like...
When was the, when did Anna Mandietti...
Oh, I knew somebody was going to bring it.
No, that was 10 years ago.
It was after that.
Yeah. At least 10 years ago.
Because I remember we disliked him for some reason, I can't remember what it was.
Retrospective verdict that many people delivered.
That's what I remember.
No, but I think it was interesting that this connection between art and politics had so much plasticity to it, you know, and you have this, and then you have that, and as a young person, I'm like trying to sort it out, and still working on it.
Right. Listen, I think that we had a position, at least as a group. I don't know what we might have suppressed or repressed, but we had a position that art like that was ridiculous. The idea of somebody creating irresponsible.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm okay. Right. You say irresponsible. I say ridiculous. But, you know, there was a kind of like really sort of populist kind of, I don't know. It's almost as if it's a kind of like hearty har har. This is so remote and so arcane. How could this be remotely interesting or useful? And it's just, I don't think maybe I did say it to you when I gave you a hug at the Printed Matter book fair, or maybe in an email, because we had a lot of emails back and forth in the process. But I so appreciate, Greg makes this kind of confession in his afterword about, which you can read about, I'm not going to go into it, but at the time that we were doing what we were doing, he was engaged in serious study. I'm not saying we were doing serious study too, but of another kind, but really trying to look at these questions about form too, which I think actually matter. You know, form matters, and you can never really separate form from content anyway, and trying to have a more kind of a less prescriptive notion than, say, we can only work in this vernacular of realism. What is realism anyway, right? And certainly of a kind of social. Now, when I went to Detroit for the Social Forum, this was the first time I saw those Diego Rivera murals in the museum, which were unbelievable. And I feel like in a way, I've sort of veered towards a kind of became very prescriptive about anti-social realism, and then you see something like that project. So there's no inherent anything about any question of form, right? There's nothing inherently. But anyway, but
Rivera,
I think
Rivera would have probably considered himself quite a formalist.
Exactly. Yeah.
Social realists.
I suppose. I think that we also didn't take the time to, aside from the Ana Mendieta controversy, which is of course huge, and with which he's tainted forever, whether he likes it or not. But I think there was a way that we didn't have a kind of patience. I mean, the thing is, what would be great is to have a kind of world where you can have a lot of time to spend in kind of discussing these things and enjoying them, and not deciding for people in advance what they're ready to deal with. I feel like I'm talking too much. I say that to my students. I'm talking too much now. It's not for you to talk. There was a story, I think I put it in the book, where we met Jose Padilla, Shelley DeCorn. Jose Padilla, who's a Cuban installation artist who became an emigre, who at that point was still living in Cuba and visited Chicago in the mid-80s, came to the Puerto Rican Cultural Center, and a couple of artists, we got together with him. And it was really interesting because he was working at that time with very sort of primitive but also very sophisticated kind of abstractions of materials to connote a kind of experience, an idea of living in Cuba. And it was not realism. And he talked about a conversation he had with sugarcane workers who said, after working in the fields all day, we don't really want to see pictures of the fields. We want art to take us someplace else. Open it up. Yeah, take questions. Questions or comments?
So if anyone has any questions, I can try to run this back to you, or some of you have some loud voices you can use too.
Thank you, Sarah.
I wanted to know, can I make a comment and then ask you a question? My comment is particularly in the way in which you kind of interrogate race and how you kind of think through what is the role of white activists in relation to challenging white supremacy in some way or another. I think that you could have a really interesting conversation with white Africans, particularly those of us that were involved in kind of anti-apartheid work,
mm-hmm.
and who grew up in Zimbabwe and places like that.
Yeah.
Because I think some of the questions that you ask are interesting. I think some of your answers are sad in some ways, And I think that there are more optimistic versions of that, that in part, and this is where my question is, come from a different way of engaging with the society in which you grew up in. So this is my question. Who is the audience for your art? Who were you trying to reach? And to what extent, as you reflect back now, do you think that you achieved that?
Thank you. I would love to know more, and maybe I'll give the mic back to you in a minute about what you find sad, because I think that's interesting. Being kind of a melancholic, but I'm actually an optimist. But anyway, I think that we saw our audience. I mean, the thing is, maybe I didn't make this clear in the comments, but I did show you some more ephemeral posters and flyers that we repasted that were for events, that were for activities, that were that meant to be given away and distributed. And then we made these very ambitious prints that we sold in order to raise money, which we considered as material aid to the struggles of oppressed nations. Our analysis was that those in the U.S. as a prison house of nations, those were our political priority, and to give material aid to meaning it was consequential, was not just symbolic, to raise, to do something that could maybe change, could help, could aid in some kind of way. And so I think that was a huge priority for us, and I think that we also saw our graphics as targeting other white people who could be enjoined to become revolutionaries like ourselves. But it became an increasingly rarefied project, because at one point we, and Laura and I, were trying to track this, and we could not remember what the origin of this phrase 100 communist soldiers was, which was a kind of symbolic of, if we could do that, that would be, I mean, I think, you know, we're thinking, looking at the model of John Brown, who of course is celebrated by many, not the mainstream culture, but who at the time was characterized as a horrible terrorist, misguided madman. But I think we saw ourselves as that model, and we were very much influenced by a kind of idea of folkloreism, of a small motor provoking a larger mass movement. And we saw the most consequential struggles in the United States as being, well, particularly the black movement. And I think what was right in our analysis, well, we were taking into account a history of white supremacy that meant that there was no, it's a big version, because the version I have is small.
It's the Carl Andre, it's been returned.
But I think our audience, I mean, there was a time when Madam and Graphics Collective was working in coalitions with artists in New York, like Action Against Racism in the Arts, which started as a response to a show called The Nigger Drawings, which was an artist being like, his drawings were a series of abstractions of black on white. A white artist, yes, whose name we don't even have to remember. Okay, it's in the book. But that response provoked a huge kind of outpouring. I mean, well, not huge, but qualitatively very important outpouring of identifying racism and white supremacy as huge issues, not just within the art world, but outside of it. And so, you know, the Atlanta Emergency Exhibition was an expression of that. So there was a period when we were active with artists, like, well, some of them, you know, very well-known artists, not so well-known, but really doing this kind of coalition work. But that became less and less what our practice was. Rudolf Baranek, who was a wonderful artist, who was part of all these movements going back to the Vietnam War, brought his class from Pratt to our last studio as a kind of studio visit to an activist graphics collective, and we spent the time haranguing him and his students why they should support the Black Liberation Army and nothing else mattered. So there, you know, that maybe that is a little bit sad. I mean, in the sense that it wasn't the impulse I think was very heroic and very good, but we made it very difficult for people to relate to us.
Mary, if I could tack on to that.
Of course you can.
Just real quick, what was the discussion that went on when you decided to be in the group material show? Because that clearly seems like a very different kind of audience framing from what...
You know, I don't, Laura, I don't know if you have any recollection of this, but I think the fact that we were invited was amazing because, you know, because people really stopped. I mean, I lost friends during this period. I'm sure other people did too, because we made it impossible to have a discussion, much less relationship with people with whom we had political differences. It wasn't even about political differences. It was all about political line. So the fact that they invited us was, I don't know, maybe they thought that it would be kind of a kick, kind of interesting.
But it wasn't, if the Museum of Modern Art headed by you, wouldn't have gone, but, you know, it wasn't.
So. Well, that's,
But, Mary, sure. I think part of it was that we wanted to be part of something bigger. We did want to organize white people, and I feel like, I mean, that was sort of, when you said that, that was sort of our difference over the first draft, because to me, and I just came before this from a dinner that's given every year for the families of political prisoners, and most political prisoners, like most prisoners in this country, are black or other third world people, and every year it's grown, and this year it was huge. It was really, it was wonderful. And if I was thinking when you were saying, you know, who doesn't know us, if, you know, when we walk in there, when anyone who's been in prison, when anyone of us, when we went to Lolita's, that memorial, you know, we get people recognize, people in those movements recognize the solidarity. So that's one thing. Another thing is that we were in this very mixed time, and those of us who went underground and did actions in the 80s based on the rise of national liberation and the wars that were going on in the 70s were an example of it. So we were caught in this period when there had been war against communities of color in the United States that were part of the worldwide war, and there were wars going on and people were winning around the world, and so we were very focused on that. That's another thing. And the third thing is I'm now on the other end of it. I'm like, you know, let a million flowers bloom, and you know, I'm an Occupy, and I love all the
million, wow.
Right, millions and millions. I love all the, like Josh says, his favorite thing about Occupy was in the beginning when everyone had their own sign, yeah, handwritten, and some of them were loony, but it was everyone's sense of how they were affected by, you know, by whatever they defined, imperialism, capitalism, just, you know, the mortgage crisis, whatever. And it was everyone's voice. And so I'm into that now. And there are some left groups that are coming into the prison work at Occupy, and I see them and I recognize it. They're waiting there to say their campaign. And that was us. You're part of an organization. So it was a coming together of those very specific race politics where we did think you had to talk about white supremacy. If you talked about racism, you were a liberal and we couldn't do anything with them. And the other thing was the cadre organization where we had our program, and it was so important that we had to wait. We couldn't really listen. We couldn't really be part of something. You couldn't take the risk that other ideas would come out that wouldn't build the program that we felt responsible for. So this is just a couple of things. But what Josh always says when we talk about this,
Josh,
is that our posters spoke a language that was recognizable because it was being spoken all around the world. And the guns came from what was happening around the world. So it was kind of, you know, an expression of something very exciting and very good. And if there had been a revolution, if there were, you know, black power in this country, then maybe the ending would be happier too.
Remember being called a liberal by leftists and feeling horrible, you know, it's just like what a different experience.
Right.
I'm called a liberal.
And
obviously.
These days, I'm just having so much fun with racism. White supremacy is like, you know.
Talk, wait. What, the mic?
Well,
no, she'll talk.
No, I really don't want to talk, but
loud people. I work with I teach at a state university, and I'm just like, you know, white supremacy is not a term that I'm, when I say it, they kind of look at me and I have to explain myself.
Did anyone else have any questions or comments?
Yeah,
you could
project
or come up to the mic.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, just a follow-up question on the...
Who are you?
Oh, my name's Daniel. I'm from Chicago. And a follow-up question on the audience for the posters is also, I think as I've read through the book, I have been kind of wondering about the audience for the book, because it's because of this unique way that, as you said, that you bring together, you know, that you bring together left history and art history, there's a kind of there's such specificity in terms of who is going to kind of be let's say like adept, or sort of who's going to be literate enough of the left and the art history to kind of like be able to approach it. And so I'm curious about kind of your ideas about who the audience is or who it could be, and, you know, and also just sort of your ideas or hopes or aspirations in terms of other ways it might get into the world. Because I do think it's very, very unique, and I really like it a lot, what you've done in terms of the combination of the various histories. And I also think the approach in terms of the kind of reflection that you bring is pretty unique in the genre of sort of like also like movement memoirs and stuff. So anyway, just whatever you have to say about that.
I'll just say really quickly that, and also Marco Pelletier is here, just noticed, hey Marco, one of the other artists whose work you saw, were you here earlier? Did you just sneak in here?
I did get here later.
Okay, so maybe you missed seeing some of your beautiful work. Anyway.
Well, I'm important to the book, and I...
Okay. You might have something to say, too. But Daniel, one of the things Daniel did for many years in Chicago was he produced this publication called Area Chicago, which still exists, but he sort of phased out of it. And he invited me to... do some different projects for it, different writing projects, and one of them was a sort of extended excerpt from this manuscript that wound its way into the book. I just want to say that, so thank you for your support, man. Anyway, we're comrades. So, but Daniel, you know that when Josh McPhee and Derek Greenwald asked me to write this essay for what was going to be the Exit Art, The Signs of Change book, which then became something else, they gave me extensive notes about audience, like imagining a broader audience that was still, you know, what we used to call progressive or, you know, but more extended communities for whom terms like cadre organization weren't self-evident. Not like, I mean, I don't want to be prescriptive. You know, these things have different interpretations. But they gave me an extent. So their work with me on the book is what yielded the necessity for the scholarly convention known as footnotes, which is important. I think a lot of us like the footnotes often better than the text sometimes, and the indexes and so on. But so there's, you know, because there's... I mean, the thing is, this little project is kind of part of a larger bunch of projects that I and a lot of people in this room who participated in this same episode have. We have our different ways of making meaning out of these heretofore extreme experiments in the idea of a possibility of revolution. I mean, that's, you know, the... the world has shifted. I mean, we don't have any, none of us have any, I mean, we have to dispense with romance on the one hand, but we have to have a certain kind of passionate imaginary in order to kind of be, you know, emblematize a kind of world that we envision. It's not on some far off trajectory, right? So there have been expanded, and I have to also tell other, you know, some of the people in the room are contemporaries of Daniel's. Many wonderful folks who used to be or have connections with this Chicago scene of people who are at least a generation younger than me, but who've been, on the one hand, really curious, but also critical, but really wanting to have, to make a record of these kinds of experiences and histories and genealogies. And it's amazing to work with people like that, who also, you know, sort of keep you on your toes and prevent you from, I mean, I don't think I've ever been a nostalgist. I don't think. But you know, it's easy to sit around with the old folks and, oh, do you remember when we did this? Anyway, so audience. I mean, and the thing is, it is hard. It's a constantly, you know, people synthesize these things differently, and it's not necessary to create a synthesis. So you know, Greg's been doing this work around under the umbrella of the language of dark matter, which is so fascinating because it's using all this wonderful stuff in physics to kind of as a metaphor in a way to talk about, you know, what's not recognized, or what's certainly not understood, what can't be contained within a prevailing discourse of in terms of certain art practices. And I think you know, all of us have to be challenging ourselves all the time to. You know, to make ourselves relevant to a bunch of challenges of what it means to be alive. I don't know. God, I'm sounding like you like that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I do.
In 1979, I was 19 in Madison, Wisconsin, and I don't know if you, I mean, the question was, who's your audience, who's your intended audience, but I'm realizing, seeing these images, that I and my friends, we had a socialist feminist collective, we were definitely anti-imperialist, and we all still feel that way. We don't use the word so much anymore, but the women's symbol with the gun through it is absolutely one of my all-time favorites, and I've been drawing that, repeating that all over, remembering that we had a Christmas tree. It's a white people's tradition, but we made the Africa symbol that you guys had in the Attica poster, or one of them. We would make Christmas tree ornaments based on you guys' art.
With the outline of the continent.
Yeah, the art outline of the continent.
Okay.
The co-ops and the bookstores and the feminist houses in Madison had your posters on them. I remember being very influenced by the one with the lipstick and the slapped face. So, right on. Thank you. I feel I owe you guys a debt of gratitude. Yeah, I mean, you symbolized, you added a lot to American culture. You did what you felt you had to do at the time. I mean, that was what the 70s and the anti-Vietnam War was about, right? Is we got to stop the war, and we don't know who's going to. And you made a record of that, and that, I think, was influential to, to me, and then to that, to the extent that there are other people like me that are, you know, white and professionals and carry on working as hard as we can and still holding true to the same values that you typify. I think that, again, we owe a debt of gratitude. So thank you.
Emily. A lot of people in the room are really, you know, good friends of Dad, and that's part of what's happening.
I read the free publication from the Signs of Change show, and it meant an incredible lot to me, and I meant to write you a long letter about it, and I never could do it. But one of the things that was really important to me about... let's not get into that. One of the things that was amazing to me about reading the booklet after knowing you for many years and sort of knowing some of your practice, but not more just your analysis of the world and less where it comes from. I guess one thing that fascinates me about your cohort, this cohort, is the way that you, for me, model what a potential cultural and political practice of being a white queer woman could be, what sort of commitments a queer person might have outside of, you know, gay self-empowerment. And I'm only mentioning it because you didn't mention it in this talk. You didn't mention it in this talk, but you did. Right. But you do talk about it in the booklet. And it does, I mean, the ways in which your identity and your embodiment was erased in the Madam Bin May 19th era, and then is the full trajectory of kind of where you guys all went in terms of your political practice after getting out of prison, and the ACT UP era, like that thread of connection about all these white, queer, anti-imperialist women who were doing this particular kind of work that involved a lot of self-erasure and like kinds of militant solidarity work in the early part of the 80s, and then what kind of care work grew out of that in terms of ACT UP, like the full thread of all y'all's biographies in terms of what kind of cultural and political work you and interpersonal community work you've been doing over time. Yeah. To me, the more I can sort of pull that thread out and have continuity, it gives me so much so much of a better lens of this history and like a way to connect myself backwards through the 80s to, you know, mythologized 60s politics actually makes some fucking sense of it. So I just want to throw that out.
Thank you, Emily. There's a lot there, and thank you for this weird thing about these, oh god, you know, everything is a performance, but you know, you just wind up inherently kind of excluding certain things. There's always that kind of erasure that's just involved in language or something. But the thing is, for me, is that there were actually, I mean, you're drawing out a continuity, but for me, and I don't know, there are a bunch of people in the room who did this AIDS work in the context of being incarcerated, you know, imprisoned, and under the worst conditions where, you know, all the prohibitions were compounded, all the need was compounded, and so on. And there are a lot of stories to be told. There's some of which have been told and continue to need to be told. For me, the thing about ACT UP, and even before ACT UP, about being affiliating with openly queer people who were kind of refugees in a way of this anti-imperialist movement while simultaneously still doing it. I mean, it really was a more of a discontinuity and a kind of rupture, because it wasn't about self-interest in the narrowest sense, but it had something to do with placing the fullness of our lives in the middle of our lives. And that was a kind of break which was hugely important. And there are stories that need to be told. I couldn't figure out how to do it in this small scale, but again, kind of packed essay, about what it meant that May 19th was mostly white lesbians working with revolutionary nationalists who kind of tolerated that, but we never talked about it. And I mean, people's politics have changed and shifted, but, you know, who sort of like put up with it, even though for some people we worked with, it was a kind of ideological, like, it was a, you know, our lives were a manifestation of, you know, bourgeois decadence or whatever. But, you know, we didn't have those kinds of, at least the circles I was in, the small circles I was in, we didn't have those kinds of discussions with our comrades. And previous to May 19th, there was this funny story that circulated around the New York Women's School, which is a project of which we were a part, and did have a broader range of feminists and lesbian feminists and And then we kind of gained political hegemony at one point. But there was a time before that when we used to have these intense debates about class and race, and where we were characterized by a friend of mine when we were still friends, when we would have a kind of conversation where she could say, "You all are people who are, you're lesbians from the neck down." And I was so struck by that because I thought, wow, well, at least we're still having sex. No, I mean, it's because we actually had lesbians from the neck up in our group who felt that they needed to model themselves on a lesbian identity, even though, you know, that's not what, you know, made their boat float, so to speak. So I think there's a lot to say there, which I don't say, and
would a lesbian from the neck up for her, would that have meant that lesbian, like, was she a lesbian, like, national, was she a nationalist? Like, was it
no,
that
it was like,
the
no, it was like, you no, know, she needed to sleep with another girl.
Oh, she's straight.
Not a straight girl gets hot for a lesbian. If you read anything from radical feminism and lesbian histories, there was a kind of politics about, you know, feminism is the theory, lesbianism is the practice. And I think that the thing is also, there's a lot of, you know, when everyone around you, I mean, there are a lot of really powerful, smart, beautiful women. And, you know, there is a kind of attraction and energy and so on, but it wasn't really for everybody. I mean, you know, I know sexuality is fluid, but we all know how that goes. It gets fixed.
Were you refugees from?
I got red. I know. Talking about, I was raised Catholic. It makes me embarrassed.
I was. I mean, I was wondering if you were on some level refugees from the internecine politics of the women's movement too, like the.
Oh yeah, except well, we. We became enforcers. So,
you're enforcers.
Well, we sort of saw, like, a certain very strong ideological group of lesbian separatists who called themselves Fort Dyke. Remember Fort Dyke? Well, yeah, there was a whole range of polemics that we did. This is sort of early days of man. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating stuff.
Wait,
but it's
what
another.
Was happening though?
No, we were engaged in a struggle with a political line that said patriarchy, that there has to be a kind of base foundation. I mean, everybody had they were fighting about the foundations of things. We're in a different period now.
Not really.
No,
I'm so sorry. Oh no, what would you like
no,
to know?
I mean, this stuff is what those battles were.
It's shifted foundations.
Okay. Every one of you, when you tell your story, and at which point the linear history doesn't line up, like the fact that you thought you were completely alienating yourselves and going underground at the same moment you did the group material show, and the fact that there is this paradox in terms of how you look at the history. As somebody who wasn't alive for a lot of that history, trying to stack it up and make sense of it because of all of those paradoxes. It's just so useful when you can have them all together and really talk through the paradox, which you're really good at. You're really good at problematizing things. Right? But it's a gift to not simplify and to not say, no, there isn't that paradox. But I guess knowing that when you were doing May 19th, you were involved in this engagement around the struggle around patriarchy and in relationship to the prioritization of fighting white supremacy is like, that's still really relevant.
I didn't mean to say it wasn't relevant, and I'll give it to you. No, my view is that people seem less interested now in debating the sort of foundational. Am I wrong about that? Oh, I guess I'm totally too optimistic.
I mean, I would just say that the same dialogue exists about foundations, and also I think a lot of. For me, all of my elders, like you and Laura and Susan and my mother, would say, oh no, but things have changed so much
regarding dialogues about patriarchy, and I keep saying, no, I really haven't, and that we're continuing to fight these similar battles. So, regarding patriarchy as a structure.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is nostalgia. I mean, our fear of nostalgia, our desire to engage in nostalgia, like, that is what keeps us from being able to go, I mean, like, the debate around patriarchy or any sort of, you know, second wave stuff is, like, stuck in time. Like, we can't, it only existed in that time, we can't go back. It's, I don't know.
It's just that the language and the means have to change. I guess what, I don't know, maybe we'll just, we'll have this discussion more over time, but I do feel like there's a kind of, there's a more flexible, actually more dialectical approach to thinking about oppressions as not competing with one another, which doesn't mean, I mean, they're really very, there's a lot of work that has to be gone into, you know, because feminism is many things, right? Depending upon who's embodying it and who's articulating it and what national circumstances exist and blah, blah, you know. So, I mean, you know, there are huge feminist debates that are happening in Iran. We, most of us know that, but the popular culture is, I mean. So that's, I just, you know, the idea of people having these fights over primary contradictions. It's still happening. Okay, all right, it's still happening.
And it's still like the basis from which you would have to figure out your stand for you to be able to actually do healthy solidarity work, as opposed to the unhealthy aspect of what Madam Bin did in their solidarity
work. I guess I suppose, you know, suppose for me, like, the ACT UP model was so much, I don't want to romanticize that either, but was so much more kind of relational and situational. Was actually, it was really about coalescing around one demand around national health care. At a certain point, was our best point, the most anti-racist point, or most kind of where all the, and we failed at that, but that's not just our fault. Did anybody else want to?
You feel spectacularly, then not too tried.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not going to identify her because it would embarrass her, but I have a beloved cousin in the audience, and she could testify that how impossible it is to talk to her.
Still or?
Should we call it a day?
Before we wrap it up, can I ask you about Judy Clark?
Oh, God.
And I know you have some things to show people about Judy Clark, but. Yes, because that's what your chest is telling me right now.
Scapula. Well, Shelley just gave me this big button, please, which is, Sana says, please ask me about Judy Clark. Anyway, this very, I'm wearing a very small button. I think a lot of you, I saw heads nod here. I mean, people who I don't know in the room, many of you have probably read the New York Times Magazine article on Judy Clark, who was one of the key leaders of May 19th, who was also involved in the Brinks robbery and who's been doing now 31 years of a 75 to life sentence, and she's now 62. I urge you to read that article. And most importantly, to think about, first of all, if you know about Judy, no matter, I think there are valences of opinion about Judy's politics and her, the way she's reconciled herself to our shared history. I will say this, that when Judy wrote a letter to a journal called Prison News some 10, 12 years ago. Somebody here has the right year. It was a letter of apology to the families of the three men, two cops and one security guard, who died October 20th, 1981. There was also another person who died, Matari Sundiata. I'm sorry. Shabaka Sundiata. who died 2 days later. So there were four people, actually, who died with Brinks. Judy wrote this letter of apology, which was spurned by a number of people I know who were above ground activists who characterized it as deplorable and a kind of betrayal of our politics because she was apologizing to cops. And I have a long-standing relationship with Judy, and we actually love each other and argue and talk and actually enjoy each other through all this time. And we became very close after she was imprisoned. And my position on this is that she and all of us have the autonomy to decide how we reconcile these emotions, which are as meaningful as any other kind of intelligence that we might have in the aftermath of those events, and that she deserves to be out of prison. Just plain and simple. As does David Gilbert, as does Oscar Lopez Rivera, as does Sundiata, you know, all these different prisoners, some of whose names have been mentioned tonight, have different kinds of ways that they narrate and make sense of their histories. And anyway, that if you were to ask me about, you didn't ask me, but I'm telling you, I just told you something about. So there was this very little button which I distributed in a project I work with in Chicago called the Chicago Torture Justice Memorial Project. Some of you know Chicago's been infamous for practicing torture against black men, especially under the watch of former commander John Birch. That's another story, that project. But I had 30 buttons, and I got rid of a third of. I didn't get rid. I gave away a third of them that night because everyone was interested in wearing one. There are these very small buttons that seem to imply that you have to have a somewhat intimate relationship with someone. Well, now there are these big ones. Please ask me about Judy Clark, which I guess, Shelley, you have more. In the bag. Okay, so I'll just pass them around.
Is there some like website or someplace that if people are interested and moved by Judy?
Yes, you probably know the URL. I think if you Google judithclark.org. That's it.
But you should say that.
I'm sorry.
Well, I think this is kind of what Laura's getting at. But if people want to support Judy's potential release, they should write to the governor. And there's a campaign. There haven't been enough letters that have arrived at the governor's office, and this is the time to get her out. So everybody needs to write to the governor, and if you do a Google search for Judy Clark, I'm sure that her website will come up, and you can figure out how to write, or you can just write to Andrew Cuomo in Albany, I'm sure he'll get there.
Or if you want to talk to someone about it, talk to Mary or to Shelley, and they can take your email and get in touch with you and work with you on, maybe you know someone who knows the governor, or maybe you know someone who's the head of some very important organization. So, please.
Thanks, Rachel. Yeah, that's
Shelley, stand up or something so people can see. So they can
www.judithclark.org, and all the info is there. In terms of what you'll also learn is that there are actually a really excellent campaign when Patterson was governor that raised 100 really amazing, 1,000 really amazing letters. Governor Patterson wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And he was too fearful and too cowardly, as so many politicians are, to be associated with giving clemency to Judy. Anyway, there's lots of, you can look up the New York Times article, look up the letters. Actually, the letters, the comments, are kind of an interesting catalog of response. There's some pretty hideous responses there, but they're actually in the minority. So,
and there's some the letters in response to the article are in the magazine for tomorrow. Some of you may have seen them already, but there's five letters, four of which are very positive.
Right.
Including one from Judy's daughter.
And the portrait that Nan Golden did of her is so much better than the portrait that was there before. She's very grim. Lovely photo. Anyway, thank you so much. Maybe I think we should end. Thank you so much.